Today is January 31st, 1992. We're at the Holiday Inn, Providence, Rhode Island, and I will be interviewing Mr. Johnny Pesky from the Boston Red Sox for the Oral History Committee of Sabre. Mr. Pesky, you started your major league career in 1942 with the Boston Red Sox as a shortstop at the age of 22, if I'm correct.
That's right.
Okay. All right, Johnny. The first thing I want to know is, how do you pronounce your real last name?
Pavescovich. P-A-V-E-S-K-O-V-I-C-H. Pesky's a nickname. The kids called me that when I was in school. And a writer in Oregon suggested I use that. Yes, I used it, and I changed it legally in 1947 to the dismay of my parents. My parents were terribly upset. And finally, I convinced my mother and my, well, not so much my father, but my mother was quite upset. And she said, "Well, you change your name?" I says, "No, Ma." I says, "There were immigrants that came to this country and get playing ball with kids, playing hockey with kids, and they put nicknames on you, and I know a lot of kids have done the same thing that I've done."
Very good. You were a 22-year-old rookie. How did you make it to the major league so quickly when back in the 40s, 30s, that era, there were 8 major league teams per league? It seems to me, to make the major leagues at such an early age, that'd be a phenomenal feat.
Well, Peter, I had the good fortune of being around the ballpark as a child. I've been in the ballpark since I was 10 years old, and I was a clubhouse kid in Oregon. And I started to play ball in high school and semi-pro out there when I was in high school. And I signed in 1940 with the Red Sox. In 40, I was at Rocky Mount. 41, I was at Louisville. 42, I was with the Red Sox. And in those years, that's quite quick. But I had good years everywhere I was, and I expected to go to spring training with the Red Sox in 42. I expected to go back to Louisville, but it didn't work out. Joe Cronin was ready to retire, and it seemed like I fit the bill at that time. As a matter of fact, a good friend of mine competed with me for the shortstop job. It was Eddie Pellegrini. And we're great friends, and they sent him to Louisville, and they kept me, and I've had some good years. I've had a couple of down years, of course, which every ball player has, except your Whit DiMaggio and Williams and people like that, but I have no complaints. The ball club is good to me, so I have no complaints.
Okay, you played 147 games your rookie year. How did you manage to get so lucky and get a starting position? It looks like a starting position right off the bat when you said you were expecting to go back to Louisville.
Well, I had a good spring. I went to Sarasota and played, and Cronin alternated Eddie and I. Eddie had a good year in the Coast League, and I had a good year in the American Association, which they seemed to think that both leagues at that time were equally good. And they seemed to feel that the American Association had a little bit better stability than probably the Coast League at that time. But what happened here was I played so well, and I think Pelle got hurt. Eddie Pellegrini got hurt. He hurt his leg, and we had to start the season. So Cronin gave me the job, and I hit it off, and I got off to a decent start, and I just kept on playing, and I just seemed to fit. Because they had Dominic DiMaggio to me, who hit first, I hit second, Ted Williams hit third, and it was just a great thing for me. As an individual, that I, first of all, I came to a ball club that was in the building stage, and each year the Red Sox brought up a kid. We used to bring up one or two kids every spring, you know, in the 40 years. Now you bring in 8 or 10 or 15, but in those years, you had to play, and you had to make it, and the salaries weren't like they are today, believe me. Sure.
Okay, looking on, you played in 1942. Then you went into the military, and you came back in 1946. And something that intrigues me, and I've always wanted to know, is how do you readapt to baseball? How do you get your hitting stroke back, your glove back, after a layoff of 3 or 4 years? Was it difficult for you, or were you able to pretty much get back into the swing of things relatively quickly?
Well, Peter, I had a break in that respect. we went to a couple of bases that had, like, we were in the flight program, and we had to go to Chapel Hill. That was to build your body up, and they had a baseball team, they had a football team, they had a basketball team, they had a soccer team, and we got out on the field and got to play. But we had to do our work. The only time, if you were in a certain program, and they put you in a program where you had to get your work first, and say about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, if we were through with our program, then we could go ahead and play ball, which they allowed us to do. On that ball club, Buddy Hassett, who was with the Yankees, was on that club. Gary Kraft was on that ball club. Ted Williams was on that ball club. Johnny Sane was on that ball club. Joe Cusick, who was in the Cardinals at the time, was on that ball club. Sane, particularly, if you take extra hitting or something like that, you fool around with you, how to move the ball around, see if he can get you to go for things. And, of course, we had a good team. Norfolk had a baseball team. That was in 43. In 44, I went to operations school in Atlanta, and I got my commission there. In 45, I went to Pearl Harbor. In Pearl Harbor, Bill Dickey was the coordinating officer of baseball that summer, and then the football team came in after we did. But we played ball all summer. We must have played 65, 70 games. We played 3 times a week, probably. Bobby Point, Canioli. There was a number of outlying bases that we could go to and play, so we got to, and that was big league competition. And as a matter of fact, I was glad to go there at that particular time. And then about a week before the war had ended, before they dropped the island bomb in Japan, we had orders written. My orders were written to go to. I was headed for Okinawa, but it didn't materialize. Of course, the war was over, and I was struggling to get back to the States. In the meantime, I got married. I married a girl in Atlanta. I met this little girl from Lynn, Mass, and I came from Oregon, and we hit it off and got married. And it was 47 years ago.
Okay, we're back into 46 in the swing of things. We know the Red Sox won the American League pennant that year. How would you describe your season coming right out in 46?
Well, I have to say it was a good year. I mean, it was a great year for me because I wasn't a 330, 340 hitter. I maybe hit from 285 to 310 at best. But I was a middle infielder, and we didn't have to hit much, but I had the fact, you know, I was... Well, I can say this now, at my age, I think I handled the bat pretty well, and I have some records to show for it. And I just love playing. I mean, and I came to a good ball club, and we had good players, so it made it much easier for me. And we were always in contention. It was always battling for first place. And when you have that, why, you know doggone well that if you win and you get into the World Series, there's extra money for you. Heck, $5,000-$10,000. My first big league contract was for $4,000.
$4,000. Wow. You played in one World Series, 1946. How would you describe the feeling you had playing in the World Series?
Words can't describe that, Peter. It's just that's the top of the drawer for any ball player to play in the World Series. We should have been in more. You know, of course, if like Don Meredith used to always say, if ands and buts were candy and nuts, it'd be Christmas. But it didn't happen to us. But Chet Williams played in one World Series. Some players never played. Luke Appian, who's in the Hall of Fame, never played in the World Series. And it's but just being in a series, Peter, is a great feeling. We didn't even think about the money, you know. But now it's big, big business, and the players today are really in the driver's seat.
Players in the driver's seat. And we'll get to that in a little while. Back in the 30s, 40s, 50s when you played, you traveled by train, I'm sure, most of the time. What was it like traveling by train for you? And because you traveled by train and you were confined with your teammates for a prolonged period of time, what was your relationship, your camaraderie with the ball players on the team?
Very good question, Peter. You've got to remember there were only 8 teams in the American League, and the furthest west we went was Chicago and St. Louis. We traveled on train. We get on the train, we had our own Pullman, we had our own diner, the press had the the other Pullman car, and we got to know one another, and we worried about one another. There were a lot of fellows that played together a lot of years. Dominic, DiMaggio, Ted Minnings, Bobby Doyle, myself, Tex Houston, Dave Ferris, and people like that. And when you make those acquaintances as a young player, they stay with you. I still hear from a lot of the guys, especially at Christmas, but now a lot of us are in our late 60s, 70s. Probably there's few that were in their 80s. I think Wally Moses was in his 80s. I know Bertie Tebbets has got to be in his 80s. He was just a great person. And we had respect and affection for one another. And we got to know the families, you know, and it was a delightful experience, what I'm trying to say. Today, you get on an aircraft, boom, you're in a town, 2 hours, boom, you're there. Like even going to New York, you went from Boston to New York in 4 hours. Went to Philadelphia, then to Washington, Detroit, Chicago, St. Louis. It was great. It was just, you know, I guess the best time of your life is when you're a player. And it's been that way with me. You ask any ball player, I'm sure he'll say the same thing, if he's honest with you. But everything, Peter, you know, they say the good old days. There's no such thing as a good old day. Today's even better. Someone said to me, Johnny, don't you wish you were playing today? I said, how the hell can I play? I'm 72 years old. I said, but I had my day in the sun. At that time, I wasn't paid a great deal of money, but it was each year you had to play well to improve your status as a player, plus your income. And it's understandable. Now, these guys, I'm amazed. A guy will hit one home run, hit about 210, drive in about 10, 15 runs, and he wants $300,000. It's ridiculous. I mean, it's just, I can't understand that. There's an old saying when we played, to thine own self be true. If you're worth the money, go get it. I don't blame the players for asking because the owners are going to give it to them. Secondly, ballparks are different now. You're getting a lot of people come to the ballpark. There's more money involved. And you can't blame the players. I wish I was 25 and could play and have the kind of years that I had, but I wouldn't have the courage to ask for $2 or $3 million.
I wouldn't have an agent. You wouldn't have an agent. I don't blame you. Okay, an advisor, not an agent. I'm going to list off some ball players that I took out of my encyclopedia that you played with, starting at the beginning of your career and running through the end of your career. If you could, just give me a one or two sentence description of each one, what you think of them or thought of them. Okay. Jimmy Fox.
Well, I only played 2 months with him, but a great person, great person, just a great player. And everywhere we went on the road, Ted Williams would come and say, well, this is where Fox hit run. Well, Fox lost some of his eyesight the year I was there. He left the ball club in June. Just an outstanding man. Everybody was fond of him. Extremely well-liked.
Tex Houston.
There's another guy. I was at Louisville with him in 41. He was 7-0. By the 1st of June, and he'd come up to the Red Sox in 41. In 42, I came to the ball club, and it was another great association. You just don't lose the fact that he has grown older and whatever, but when we played, it was a young guy, and you knew when the game was on the line, he was there.
Bobby Doerr.
Well, there's a Hall of Famer, a perfect gentleman, a great disposition. I'd have given $1 million for his disposition. He was very calm, great player. I can't say enough about Bobby.
Billy Goodman.
He was a hitter like myself, and the funny thing, I saw him play as an 18-year-old just before he went into the Navy in Atlanta when I was stationed there. And I saw him, I think he had about 380 in that league down there during the war. And I remember telling Joe Cronin about him after we all got back, and he had to go back to Atlanta, but then they bought his contract the very next year. Billy Goodman was a good hitter, good player, very versatile, but he was better at first base than any of the infield positions.
Mel Parnell.
Great left-hander. One of the few guys who could pitch in Fenway Park. He's probably like Bruce Hurst in the last few years. Parnell was a great competitor, great pitcher, great arm.
Vern Stevens?
Well, my roommate Vern for a couple of years. And I'll tell you what, he was a joy. He was like always smiling. he took life right in stride with everything. He died a very young man, which is, I'll tell you, he was, I loved him. I just thought he was one of the greatest guys I'd ever known.
Boo Ferris.
Oh, well, you're talking about classic men. I never heard him swear, Peter. And he was an awfully good pitcher. I know. But of course, he got his start during the war because he was an asthmatic. And he kept reading about him during, in the service and all. But then when he got back from the war, and he started to pitch, and we could understand why he won all those games. He won 25, I think, in 46.
Wow. Bertie Tebbets.
Oh, boy. Bertie is an old chirping bird. You had to like him. He's just a guy that you enjoyed being around. He loved baseball. He knew baseball. I have to say, one of the brightest minds in the game of my time.
Jimmy Parasol, a guy I grew up admiring, being a former outfielder myself, and just watching before the games when I was a kid. What was he really like?
Well, I like Jimmy Parasol. It's funny, he did all those crazy antics on the field, but he was a down there. I liked him. I mean, I was there when they tried to make a shortstop out of him. And of course, we all left eventually because Woodrow came in to manage the ball club, and he wanted to change the whole atmosphere of the Red Sox. But Parasol was here's a guy playing shortstop, was one of as good a center fielder as ever put on a pair of shoes. I couldn't understand the move there. But this is what he tried to do because of it. Parasol was a good athlete, very good athlete. I liked him. I was very fond of him.
Okay, this one, I don't know how good of a ball player he was. I only remember him from the first old-timers game I took my son to. I think it was around 81 or 82 that the Sox had. And he was playing in the outfield, and ball hit the gap in right center. And my son said to me, he says, "Dad, how come he's not running for the ball?" I says, "Peter, he's an old-timer. He's about 60 years old. The guy's name is Clyde Ballmer. I heard he had a great month one of the years he was with the Sox. Could you tell me something about him?"
You couldn't believe what a kind of a month he had. Every home run, he must have hit about 15 home runs one month in July. Either tie the game or won the ball game. He came to us from Cincinnati. In those years, they used to trade players because you were looking for balance on your own team. And when Clyde came to Fenway, well, he was a superstar. My God, he did it. And he was a pretty good player. But as your son asked you, why didn't he run after the ball? Because we got too old and our feet won't carry us.
Okay, here's another one. Strange reason I'm asking about him is, about 10 years ago, we were remodeling my house, and the roof came off, and we found an old Red Sox baseball card. I don't even remember the guy's, what he did. Leo Kiely or Leo Keeley?
Leo Kiely, left-handed pitcher from New Jersey. Pitched pretty well for the Red Sox, but he didn't stay around too long.
I heard he just passed away a few years ago.
I didn't know. I know the Globe and the Herald have a list of guys that have died in the last year or so. There's quite a list. I'm glad I didn't see my name in that list.
Another person that Sabres asked me to interview is Walt Dropo.
Waller was an excellent, excellent first baseman, a good hitter. Hit 39 home runs one year, more than 139. He was great. You throw him the ball anywhere, he could catch it. He loved to play. Waller's still around. He's doing extremely well. He's done well in business. But a great guy in the ball club. Could really play. Good athlete.
Is he still living in Massachusetts?
Oh, he lives in Connecticut. I think he does live in Massachusetts. I saw him. We were in New York last week for the Bat people. He was there, as were 80 ball players were there. They were honoring Mickey Mantle, Willie Mays, and Duke Snyder.
Gene Stevens.
Well, they thought he was going to be the next Ted Williams, but no way. I mean, he had a few holes, but he was a kid. I think there was, any time you compare anybody to Ted Williams, you better make darn sure you're saying the right thing. There'll never be another Ted Williams, as far as I hope I see it. And I just hope I live long enough with the Red Sox win a World Series.
George Kell?
Good player. Liked him very, very much. I went in the trade for him. He was involved in the 52 trade. There was Hootie Evers, George Kell, Johnny Lipon, and Dizzy Trout.
Speaking about trades, nowadays there seems to be no loyalty towards any club. How did you feel when you first got traded? What went through your mind?
Well, I always had the idea I wanted to always play for the Red Sox. But I took it in stride, you know. I didn't come out and say, well, the Red Sox didn't want me. The way we looked at baseball in those years, you trade your own brother if you thought you were going to help your ball club. And this is what the Red Sox were thinking, because we were in first place, and the trade was made the next day. And they finished sixth that year. So, you know, I don't think Gropo should have left the ball club. I know I shouldn't have left the ball club, because I could eventually become a utility guy, because I could still swing a bat. But I had some trouble with my legs, and a lot of people thought that I was wrong. I think when you're up on a pedestal, or you're up on your prime time, or in the prime of your life, you always got some knockers, and I'm no different than anybody else. I mean, I had my distractors, and some didn't think I was a good player. You know, that's their opinion. I'm not going to argue that. All I know, I was happy playing, and I tried to do my job the best way I knew how, and I did it for a number of years.
Ray Boone.
Good hitter, good player. One of the best curveball hitters in baseball. He was a fellow that could hit the ball. He eventually moved over to first base, which wasn't really, he was a big guy, but a good hitter, a good fellow. He's one of our scouts. Scouts for the Red Sox, yes.
Harvey Keene.
Oh, boy. Well, when I was with Detroit, Fred Hutchinson was the manager, and Harvey was there as a young shortstop, and Fred asked me to, you know, just talk to him. He and Al Kaline were just the kids at that time, and Billy half the pitcher. Huh? Anyway, Keene, was, you could see he was a good hitter. I said, he was one of the unusual type of a hitter. He got hit off of his front foot, but he always hit line drives, just a good player. Played 15, 18 years, I believe.
You mentioned the next one, Al Kaline.
He was just a skinny little kid, 17, 18 years of age when I was in Detroit. And we used to sit in the dugout, and I'd explain things to him. One thing that I always impressed on him, or tried to impress on him, was, Al, when you play this game, I said, you run to your position. I said, you don't have to run like you're running out of base hit, but I just run in, make an out, get off the field, but run to your position. You hit a ball, you run hard the base you're going to. And when we have an off day or we come out early, I throw batting practice to him and to a kid named Baumgart. Brooke Tuttle was the outfielder, Frank Bowling, Reno Victoria. And we used to call those kids the Pesky's Kitty Corps. We got along, and I played about a year and a half with Al, and I got sent to Washington, but when Al Kaline went into the Hall of Fame, I didn't know this until a guy from Coca-Cola, of all places, was in New York when he was there receiving an award, and of course the writers were around him, and he said to Kaline, he says, Al, did anybody have any influence on your career? He says, yes, he says, Pat Mullen, the outfielder, and Johnny Pesky. That's quite a compliment. Here's a guy who just went in the Hall of Fame. He played for 17 years in the big leagues. We've had a lot of kids that have done that through the process that we've gone through and what we've done.
Now you're talking 17, 18-year-old kids. In 54, you went to Washington. There was an 18-year-old kid who, when I was young, I idolized him. Harmon Killebrew.
Harmon Killebrew was from Payette, Idaho. He was all set to go to the University of Oregon and play for a fellow that I played high school ball with and then semi-pro, a kid named Don Kirsch. who was hurt badly in the Battle of the Bulge. And Harmon was going to, I guess he met Donnie Kirsch when they got talking while he wanted to sign with Washington. Senator Welker, who had seen Harmon play, I guess. He was just a bulky kid, 18 years old. And when he talked to Kirsch, he says, if you're going to Washington, I just joined the Washington Club, but I was only there a couple of months. That was the end of my career. Well, anyway, Kirsch told Harmon Killebrew, well, when you get to Washington, you look up Johnny and tell him who you are and that we're friends and all this, and which he did. Now, Harmon joins the ball club, and Eddie Einan, who was our traveling secretary, came to me and he says, Johnny, I want to put this kid with you as a roommate for the rest of the season. And he said, would you object? I said, no. He's practically an Oregonian. I says, I'd be glad to room with him. And then we ate together, had breakfast together, went to the park together, and he used to always call me Roomie, even when he was went to Minnesota. You know, he had all those home runs, you know. What, he hit 500 and some? Huh? Yeah, no, 500. Ted hit 521, yeah. So I says, yeah, I says, our room, we hit a lot of home runs. I hit my 17, he hit his 500 and some. Great kid, just a great kid.
Okay, two more. And you mentioned them both quite frequently as you've been talking. Dominic DiMaggio and Ted Williams.
Well, I'll start with Dom first, Peter. To me, Dominic DiMaggio was the perfect player. Knew how to play, could run, could throw, and could hit. We had a sign, and if I gave him the sign, he would take off. And we used to have a bunt and run play. He'd take off, and I'd make the third baseman field the ball. He'd almost wind up on third base. But one day, we're playing the Yankees in New York. Bill Dickey, this is his last year of his, this is right after the war. And we're in New York, and evidently the Yankees were reading those papers too, so laid down a bunt in New York, a beautiful bunt. The third baseman came in, Dominic took a look, and he didn't see Dickey when he took off. Dickey took off, was at third base. Throw went to first base from the third base, from the first base, and threw it back to Dickey, who was covering third. And Dominic slid into him, and Dominic said to him, what are you doing here? He says, I got you. Teddy, what can you say? Your words just, you know, every adjective has been used about him. As a matter of fact, I just talked to his house this morning. I could find, you know, when he had the slight stroke, concerned us all, because it's, you know, it's our era. As I said, told you earlier when we were talking, that there was a closeness with Dom and Bobby and myself and Tex Houston and those people. So Williams, I never saw Cobb, I never saw Ruth, I never saw Geary, but they couldn't have been better than him. None whatsoever.
What was he like off the field? Fun-loving guy? Have a good time? Was he always serious? Or?
No, he was a kid. In 1942, we stayed in the same hotel on Bay State Road in Boston. And we used to eat together. We'd go down and have a steak, whatever, down on Boylston Street there. And Jimmy O'Keefe, who was a great Red Sox fan and a great friend of Joe Cronin's and Mr. Collins. And we ate together a lot. That first year, we were together quite a bit, and we ate it. Wait for me and I'd wait for him, whatever the case might be. But then, of course, you know, he was the greatest hitter, you know, and the last of the 400 hitters. So I felt quite proud that he would even stick around with me. But I know when I was sick about 9 years ago, he called me in the hospital three or four times. And he sees me, I see him in spring training, and he bellows at me, you know, that's his way of doing things, but I understand, Mr. Williams. Just a great person. He's been a great friend.
Okay, you retired in 54. What did you do from 54 on, your career baseball man? It was around 63, 64, you became manager of the Sox. What did you do prior to becoming manager?
Let's see, 1954, I went to Denver as Ralph Houck's player coach. I played in about 90 games, pinch hitting, played a little, and I hit 340. And then they were, of course, at my age, I was 36, I believe, at the time, 37, and Ralph told me, or suggested to me, to manage, and I had no idea. I didn't know whether I wanted to manage or not, but I was on the field early when we had Bobby Richardson and Herzog and those people, Woody Held, and Daryl Johnson was on that club. So anyway, a couple teams contacted me, and so I went to work for Detroit. I worked for them for 5 years, and then I came back to the Red Sox in 61 and 62. 63 and 64, I was hoping I'd go back to Seattle because I had about 8 years experience at that, seven years experience about at that time, so, and Mr. Yawkey wanted to make a change, but he moved the manager up to the, Mike Higgins at the time, moved him upstairs to be a general manager, and we just never seemed to think on the same level. And listen, the first year we had a pretty good year. The second year we didn't do as well, and I got fired. And when I got fired, as I said, when I got traded, I just didn't say a word. So I went over to Pittsburgh. I was there for 3 years, and then there was a change made in Pittsburgh, so I managed their Columbus club. I had Richie Hebner on that ball club. I had Freddie Patek on that ball club. I had Al Oliver on that ball club. They're all kids, all 19 years of age. Manny Sanguin and Doc Ellis was on that club. John Kennedy, super sub that later came to the Red Sox. There were some good players, and they were young at the time. But what we did, I know, I always felt this way. You get, when you got young players, you better bring them out and work them a little bit. And that's what we did, and they responded. Hebner got 18 years in the big leagues. Oliver got 20. Patek got 15, 16. Sanguin got 15. So they did very, very well.
Speaking of young kids, when you were with the Red Sox, you managed a 19-year-old from the North Shore, Tony Conigliaro. Tragedy. How would you compare him at a young age, and if he didn't have his injury, where do you think he could have gone to as a player?
Well, you have to go by what you saw in those early years, Peter. There's no telling how far he could have gone, because he was the youngest player ever to give 100 home runs at an early age. Tony Conigliaro came to spring. He only played about 25 games in minor league ball. He broke his finger. He came to, we had to protect him and put him on the big league roster, and he came to spring training, and he's hitting balls, and he had good speed. He could run. He had a good arm and a good hustler. And he was just an icon, absolutely fearless at the plate. And I think when you're a right-handed hitter, you kind of, when the ball coming in, you kind of turn to your right, yeah, but he turned and the ball hit him in the eye and he got hit. I wasn't here. I was in Pittsburgh when that happened. But it's truly a talent that Hall of Fame numbers written all over him. Just it's one of the tragedies of baseball. But I was very lucky. I had him that 1 year, and he was just great. He had a lot of home runs, and the general manager wanted me to send him out, but I said, well, this is what spring training is for. Some Mickey Mantle was had a good spring, and they took him, but they optioned him out. I said to Higgins, I said, if he has, we'll try him for a month and see what happens. If he doesn't cut it, well, then we'll send him to Louisville. But he did well, and he was there the whole year, and you know what he's done.
How would you describe the owner of the Red Sox, Tom Yawkey?
Well, Mr. Yawkey was just outstanding. He just helped so many people. You know, they said he was too easy on his players, and he was this and he's that, but and he's helped an awful lot of people. That's what I got. I know he even helped me and my family when we were first coming along, and I have no regrets. And he treated everybody the same. He liked to come in the clubhouse and talk. He'd go up and sit in his box and watch the game. In those years, especially in the 40s, you know, we had those good teams. We wanted to win it so badly for him we could taste it. We all talked about things like that, about how Mr. Yawkey was. But you see, Peter, in those years, you had the single owner. You had Mr. Yawkey and Mr. Griffith in Washington, Mr. Mack in Philadelphia, Briggs in Detroit, Comiskey in Chicago, DeWitt in St. Louis, and then you had Mr. Barrow in New York. So it was a different ball of wax, and again, you don't like to refer to all those times, but there were good people, as individuals, and you had great admiration and respect for them. Now today, you see players want to play for, and they want to move around. Well, if the money is there, I guess the bottom line is money, Peter. I'm sure if somebody offered me a couple of hundred grand, I might take a hike. But it's never been approached to me.
2 years ago, was it? They actually managed again at Pawtucket.
Yeah.
How did it feel getting back managing?
Well, it was fun. I mean, they just wanted the club wanted to make a change, and when I joined them, there were 30 games under 500. I watched for a few days, and I saw things that shouldn't be, because we had some pretty good kids. We had Clint Deere, we had Neri, Cooper, Vaughn, Clarity. We had a pretty good ball club. I just couldn't understand, but what they were doing things that you just at that level shouldn't be happening. So I wanted we were in Rochester for a series, and we were there for 4 days. First game they really beat us. Second day we got a 5-run lead in the seventh inning. We blow that. Next night we got a 3-run lead in the eighth and blow it. The next night we got a 2-run lead in the ninth and blow it. But it was just things that shouldn't happen. Throwing the ball past people and hurrying the throws and this sort of thing. And so after the game, I closed the doors and I said, when we get home, I want everybody on the field at 2:00. When we got home, I explained to them, I said, guys, this is pretty good players here. I said, there's something wrong. And I said, I explained to them what I wanted to do. I did a drill with the pitchers. I got through, they did their running. Took the infield, did a drill with them. And I did one with the outfield, and the next day I brought the infield out. I gave them a good workout about, you know, how to approach the ball. You know, when you had to hurry, you had to hurry, but when you, like you had a Cooper and a Nearing, and a kid named McDougal, black kid, that had great arms. I says, God gave you a good arm, you use it. Don't be that fancy, Dan. Get the ball and make sure. And we started to win a little bit. The last month and a half, we were pretty good ball club. I wish that had gone a month earlier. We wouldn't have finished last. I know that.
With all the training techniques the modern ball player has, is it possible to compare the talent from when you played, your era, to the ball player of today? Is there any fair way to compare, say, a Roger Clemens to a Lefty Grove or whatever, you see what I mean?
Well, Grove was through when I got there. Clemens right now is the best pitcher in baseball. He was like Bob Feller of our era. We had a lot of good pitchers in those years. Cleveland had a great staff, had Bob Feller, they had Bob Lemon, they had Mike Garcia, they had Early Wynn. New York had Allie Reynolds, Vic Rashi, Ed Lopat, Tommy Byrne, people like that, and it was just, I think the pitching in those years was overall might be, well, I mean, again, you got 26 teams, see, and you only had 16 teams in those years. So it's kind of watered down. And you can't make comparisons. I don't like to make comparisons. I'm sure there are a lot of kids playing today could have played in our era. You know, you take a Boggs, could have. Look how long it took Boggs to get. Then he said he couldn't field. Wade Boggs made himself a good ball player. Had great work habits. Roger Clemens has great work habits. Tony Pena's got great work habits. Quintana's got, Vaughn's got good work habits. But these are the ones that stick out in your mind because they take the time. They're at the park early and they get ready and they relax. They think baseball when they get to the ballpark.
Do you think the players of today would do the things that you people would do to win ball games? By that I mean, and I don't mean a derogatory way, winning dirty, do the sacrifice bunts. You know, I remember back in 86 when the Sox won the pennant. They were winning the games. They were winning the dirty games that they had to win. They'd pull it out in the ninth inning, 10th inning. It just seems like once the ball players reach that financial plateau, they're not willing to dig down and get it. When I watch a game on TV, I like to watch the young players who are coming up, who are still hungry, who haven't reached that plateau yet. Is it still there in the major leagues consistently?
I would have to say yes. The players today have the same outlook on the game. They want to get it done. They want to do it well because it's good for them. It's good for their families. And it's good for the area. You always want the best ball player. I'm partial to the home run. I mean, but you got to balance your ball player out. You know, you don't expect Jody Reed to hit 20 home runs. You expect him to hit maybe 4 or 5. But he's a good player. The same thing with Rivera. But you got Greenwell, who should hit more home runs. Burks, you know, is going to hit home runs. Vanessa, he's going to hit home runs. Jack Clark, Mo Vaughn. Quintana's not that type of hitter. Neither is Boggs. So, and then again, it comes right down to pitching. Mm-hmm. And of course, Mr. Max said pitching was 75% of baseball. I think today it's more than 75%. Your Goodens, your Clemenses who are pitching today, they're dominant. They're like the days of Drysdale and Colfax when they were with the Dodgers. And I'm sure there'll be some young guy come along that's going to be like Clemens. And everybody makes comparisons. This guy should be. But it doesn't work that way. It's up to the individual to do that.
You mentioned a name out of the past, Mr. Mack, Connie Mack. What was he like?
Well, I just met the man. I didn't know that everybody had great respect for him, great admiration. And he had the good teams and he had the bad teams. But a very knowledgeable man of baseball. I guess he could have been the second Abner Doubleday, I guess. But thank God they invented that baseball and that bat. Kept some of us out of the working in mills, which we did as kids if we had to. And you look for a job, and now you're getting a different type of player. You're getting more college kids into baseball. In the years we played, we got a lot of, if you had 3 college guys on your team, that was a lot. Well, Williams had a high school diploma. Bobby Doerr had a high school diploma. I had a place. Dominic had a high school diploma. Tony Lupien, who was on our club for a while, he went to Harvard. Johnny Peacock was a catcher those years. He went to North Carolina, or Wake Forest, one of those schools in North Carolina.
Okay, we're probably running out of time because you have other commitments. I'd love to sit here for 3 or 4 hours and do this.
I'd put you to sleep, Peter.
No, you wouldn't. You wouldn't put me to sleep, believe me. Me being a teacher, what advice could I bring back to my students who think that, quote unquote, I'm going to make it to the bigs? How would you prepare the youth for the future in baseball, out of baseball, the letdown of not being as good as you thought you were? Kids dream, and they dream a lot of becoming a major league ball player. What kind of advice would you give them?
In the first place, your background starts right with the parents. The thing that you never get to any level unless you work at it. I don't care whether you're a doctor, a dentist, a ball player, a hockey player, whatever. If you don't work at it, you're not going to get there. It just doesn't lay itself on a plate for you. You've got to work for it. And once you hit that level, then it's nice. You've been a success, and you can walk around the town and whatever and have a great time. But have good living habits. Instruction, to have some respect for your coaches and first of all your parents. That's where it all starts. If you're very fortunate to get with a guy who's dedicated his life probably to kids, I'm sure what you are, you're a teacher, I'm sure you try to get them to do the things that you think are proper, you know, because there's so many things going on in our society today that it's now all you hear now, my son doesn't have a drug problem or an alcohol problem. That's a very important thing. And stay away from people that want to take the easy road, steal and that sort of thing. It's There's room for everybody. If you have good habits, you're gonna do it. And you've got to learn to the point. If you pick a profession, stick with it and work at it. And there's going to be disappointments in it. I mean, it's not going to be. They're not going to just say, "Here it is. This is it." It doesn't work that way. The greatest doctors in the world study for years to become doctors. Ball players work hard as you, and you can. And if you're a professional athlete, you can only last a few years. See, if you're, and they say, well, if you anything else, well, you can stay there till you're 80 or 90, or whatever. But for kids, any young kid, I think. The best advice I would give a kid is have good habits, go to school, learn. Don't be afraid to pick up a book and read it and absorb it. And if you don't know it, ask your teacher. Your teacher's there to do something for you, and I'm sure he'll direct you in the right road. That's the way I look at it, because that's the way we were taught. I mean, I have great respect for my teachers, but I don't have a college degree, but I have a brother that's got a master's. He was a frustrated ball player, and he got out, went back to school, got his degree, got his master's, and was in teaching for 35 years. So it's there. I mean, but he was a good living kid, and he's enjoyed his. He liked that atmosphere. Well, I was a baseball player, and I had some success, and I've been in it all my life. I've done nothing but baseball.
Great life. 72 years old, still involved with baseball. Looking back on your life, would you want to change anything?
I wish I was a better ball player.
I wish I was too.